that right on the biblical theme of suffering. And I don't want, this is being taped, so I won't spend a lot of time, but some have asked how my weekend went in Colorado. And it went fine. I met, like I expected, about 30, mostly lay people. There were only about two pastors. That's one reason it went so well. That was a dig at our profession. And these people were kind of social ministry leaders in their clusters of congregations, so there still wasn't the real world to be studying the arms race with these people. But it was interesting. Most of them had not asked any questions or done any work or thinking on the arms race, while at the same time they were kind of what you'd say, I suppose, in the parish, the liberal, social action-minded people. And almost all of them said that they had just decided not to think about it. It was just too horrendous. So they tended to be more concerned about things that you could get more of a handle on. So I met with a group of people that were very concerned about people, but they had most of them had chosen to just ignore the arms race. So to go into it with them and to do it like we showed in the booklet on a theological level, it was a very powerful experience for many of them. They liked your, Peter, they liked your...
Peter Kildee?
Yeah, Peter Kildee, they liked your paper. Yes. That's on tape. Anybody listening on tape that would like Peter Kildee's paper, you can write to Holden Village, right? Chelan, Washington, 98816. How I got started on this whole area of the biblical theme of suffering, I think I really started this study when I was in fifth grade, grade five. That's when and then I let it really go until last summer. But when I was in fifth grade, my older brother Phil and my younger brother Mark, Phil was in sixth grade, Mark was in kindergarten, and both of them were sick, you know, were very ill at home. And I remember the day when the doctor came to the house, that was when the doctor still came to your house, and examined both of them. And then I still remember the doctor talking to my parents. Since I was a kid, I wasn't involved in it, I just heard it from a distance. And all it took for my heart to just, or my little young life to fall apart, was to hear the word polio, and then heard the word that both of them had polio. And then I was kind of just forgotten because I didn't have polio. And all of a sudden this day was just a whirl of activity, and ambulances coming up to the house. And I remember sitting, we had a sofa that was right up against the front window where I could just kneel on there and look out the window, and then seeing the ambulances pulling away from the house with my brothers. And the siren, and then seeing them go down the street, and then I was left there alone. And I think somebody stayed with me, I would assume. But, you know, I don't remember that, but I remember in those next hours, and before I knew anything else, just screaming, as a child, screaming at God. And arguing with God, fighting with God as a child. And I even remember the words I said. I pointed out about six or seven families that I knew that were morally much worse than our family. I mean, that were really, you know, those families just ran around and they drank and played cards even, and stuff like that. And then just screaming at God, why did you decide to do this to our family? And then I remember as the weeks went on, as the weeks went on, just continuing that struggle. And I don't think I ever shared it with anyone as a fifth grader, but crying in my bed, you know, why did you do this to us? Then the next question I remember in this experience, that because my father was a pastor, the whole town was praying for my brothers. You know, they got more prayer than anybody else, almost. But then in the next hospital room was another kid about the same age who had polio, who was also prayed for by the whole town. And both of my brothers came back to health. My older brother Philip had developed, I think they called it the bulbar type of polio, which was almost always fatal, and it just arrested itself. And then I heard that the child in the next room died. You know, and then I started thinking about prayer, that this child in the next room had received just as many prayers as my brothers. They live. This child died, and I remember that not making sense to me at all. How does God run this universe? That was the question. So when I look back and I remember earliest questions about the whole issue of suffering, that's the overpowering experience in my life. By the way, about 5 years ago, I was having a physical, and the doctor hit my knee. What do they call those little things? Those little rubber things? And the way my reflex on my leg goes, he says, "Do you know that you had a very mild case of polio?" I said, "Shoot," and I didn't get any attention. Wow. Well, then the interest revived this past summer when I was, I really kind of accidentally fell into this. My brother Philip, who's a pastor in Colorado Springs, said, "I'm going to a continuing education class at Iliff Seminary in Denver, and I'm going to rent an apartment for the 2 weeks. Do you want to sign up for the same classes and then stay with me in the apartment?" And not even knowing what the classes were, I said yes. And so then when I got there, I knew this before because then I got a catalog, but found out that one of the classes I would be taking was a graduate course taught by Ralph Klein. I don't know if any of you know Ralph, teaches at Seminex. Do you know Ralph? And the theme of the course was the biblical themes of suffering. And Ralph was one of the best Bible teachers I think I've ever sat under. So I was very thankful that I fell into this. So from that experience in fifth grade and then this experience of the summer, for four times, we want to enter into the biblical people of faith just wrestling with the kinds of questions I was screaming about in fifth grade. It's exactly the same questions, you know, the question of why. You know, and God, how are you running this universe? And I don't agree with it, the way you're running things. Now, a way to personalize this and make it a living word, I think, that's helpful, is to just take a few moments now, and maybe in a group of two or three, but not more than three, share a personal experience like I just did from my history, where you really raise the question of why, or life seems unfair, or what is the meaning of suffering. Sometimes these experiences are still too painful to even share, and that's not the purpose of this, to turn this into a 1960s, what did we used to call them, you know, spill your soul. Share, or another person maybe you've met that had, for example, a death in the family where that person has really been left with the kind of the anger of life having a certain unfairness about it. So if you're willing to do that in a group of three, either yourself, your family, relative, for someone where that kind of crunch of life has come, and what maybe was learned from that. This will be fast, like 6 minutes. So just find, and I want to join one of the groups. I want to share this. Like two or three, if you want just two other or three people. You can turn the tape off now. One of the joys of community is I don't have to feel too bad about cutting this. If you're in the middle, this is something that can continue in our relationships. I was going to share another experience with another person that fits into this, but I remember my first call I made after I was ordained and installed in my first congregation. I had about 7 people call me up and say, why don't you go call on old Axel? He never goes to church. In fact, Axel hadn't been to church for about 20 years, and everybody had been trying to convert him back. And so as a new pastor with this beautiful seminary education in my pocket, I went dancing up the sidewalk to knock on Axel's door. And knocked on the door, and then naturally, since I was a pastor, we got started talking about church. People have a way of doing that. And he says, do you want to know why I don't go to church? And I said, yes, of course. So he took about 45 minutes and described the trenches of the First World War in just every horrible, bloody detail. And then in just bitterness, talked to me about the uselessness of that war and all the death and all the tragedy around him. And then he looked me right in the eye and he says, how can there be a loving God? And I remember all I could do was shake his hand, thank him, and leave. I had no answer at all and for that experience and what he shared with me. But I think I'm going to move on instead of, you know, talking about what you talked about in the groups, because the value of where we're moving is for us to focus that these are very close questions, very personal questions. And theology, I'm becoming more and more convinced that theology can only be done as a way of answering questions that we're asking about our life situations. And I found, I was sharing this with some people when I was out in Denver about the excitement about Holden Village. That we'll have a class at Holden Village on the doctrine of the Trinity, not because we announce a class on the doctrine of the Trinity, but we're involved in the whole struggle of our past of discrimination against women and exclusive language. And out of this struggle, we say, let's have a class on the Trinity. And can you feel the difference between that and putting up a little sign that says, a week from Thursday, we are going to study the Trinity? You know, that's boring theology, and that's unfortunately the way we've often taught theology. Or it's a way of saying we invite everyone, this is an old cliche by now, but it's inviting everyone to come to discuss answers to questions they're not asking. And that's what I found this weekend with these people, to spend the first part with them of really visually describing where the arms race was and what it would mean if a bomb went off, very visually, even as far as their children, their grandchildren are concerned. And once they could feel that, then to begin theologizing about the arms race then was a very life matter for those people. And I was really excited about how that happened. And that's the reason I wanted to start by focusing in on some of my struggles, some of your struggles. And now we want to move to the Bible and again see the Bible as flesh and blood people that had the same situations we have of people dying untimely deaths, unrelieved suffering, sickness with no cure, tragedy with no answers. How did these people in the struggle through all the years of the Bible try to answer these questions? And I'll share some of the things that Ralph shared with us in the class last summer. The interesting thing, we had a textbook in this class by Daniel Simonson, who teaches at Luther Northwestern. Do you know Daniel? And
yeah.
Did you have him for...
Dan Simonson is a good fellow.
Oh.
Our Old Testament class is very short.
Mm-hmm. Your what class?
Old Testament faculty is very short.
Mm-hmm. What was interesting, what Ralph Klein did, normally a professor will take a textbook, he will choose the textbook he agrees with, and then kind of teach out of that book. Well, Ralph Klein chose a book that he almost totally disagreed with as a textbook, and then each day he showed another reason why he disagreed with Daniel Simonson. He's never met Daniel Simonson, but I'm not going to get into that. But Daniel wrote on a sabbatical. He took a very pleasant sabbatical in England for a year to write on suffering. That was one of Ralph's problems. I want to look at today, draw a chart here where we're going to move. The Bible, and this goes all the way from the Old Testament to the New Testament, has a central concept of suffering that can be all wrapped up in one word. And right away we'll kind of flinch. Is that a word? Is that one? Okay. I'm improving my vocabulary. I just learned flinch. FL. And that word is the word retribution. And right away, this bothered me, and it still bothers me. But the central understanding of suffering in the Bible is retribution, meaning basically you get what you got coming. And now, around this central theme in the Bible, the dynamic of the living Bible is the whole this string going through the Bible, and then the Bible arguing with itself about it. And that's what today I want to look at, to get the very best understanding that the Bible has of retribution. And then the next three times show three different ways the Bible argues against retribution, but just some of them are retribution says basically if you obey the will of God, you'll be blessed and have a good life. If you disobey the will of God, you will be cursed and bad things will happen to you. That's basically what we mean by retribution. And the rest of the Bible will look, part of the Bible will say no, suffering is not payment for not keeping the law. Suffering is for discipline. You ever heard that one? Every one of these are ones that we've struggled with. Another part of the Bible will say, no, suffering is satanic. It's the evil power of Satan. Another part of the Bible will just come and say, well, we don't understand suffering, but we just express our anger about it. In the midst of the mystery, we cry out in anger. Another part of the Bible will say suffering is transitional. In other words, you go through suffering to reach a greater degree of glory. Joseph in Egypt went through the suffering of being the slave and being thrown into prison and everything, and through that suffering he became the prime minister. Another part of the Bible will talk about the righteous one suffering in a way that will cause God to feel so sorry that God will act. We suffer in order to force God into action. Another part of the Bible will say suffering is a mystery that we never understand. And then another part of the Bible will also argue against retribution by saying, putting words into the very mouth of God that even God himself does not agree with retribution. And I want to end with that today with an example of how the Bible says God is the God of retribution, and then part of the Old Testament will say God himself says, I disagree with that. So I want to give you a feeling of just, we're going to enter into, just as in the community here and in our own lives, the question of suffering is a dynamic question. And it's also a dynamic question all through the Bible. Probably the... let's look up Exodus 34, 6 to 8. Exodus 34, 6 to 8. And this is probably the key or the foundation passage in the entire Bible of the main theme of the Bible, which is suffering as retribution. Did you ever meet anybody that really believes suffering is retribution? Did you ever meet anybody in suffering that just cried out, what have I done? Or I must have done something? Julie Andrews sang the opposite of it in Sound of Music. Remember when her life all came together and everything was wonderful and she was in love with, what was his name? Mr. Trapp. And just everything was beautiful. She came out then with this song that was what? I must have done something good. Somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. Okay, now read, someone read Exodus 34, 6 to 8.
The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and children's children to the third and fourth generation.
Now my Jerusalem Bible says, yet he lets nothing go unchecked. Like God sitting on that check. He lets nothing go unchecked, punishing the father's fault in the sons and in the grandsons to the third and fourth generation. This is one place where exclusive language is good. All the women are free, right? Only the sons that get it, right? But notice now the theme is what is the more outstanding quality of God here in this? Before the author says, but, however, or yet, what is the characteristic of God?
Steadfast love.
Yeah, just steadfast love and mercy to thousands. And a God of tenderness and compassion, slow to anger, rich in kindness and faithfulness. For thousands he maintains his kindness. He forgives faults, transgressions, sin. Yet, remember this, he lets nothing go unchecked, punishing the father's fault and the sons and the grandson, or you could say the children and to the grandchildren, to the third and fourth generation. One thing we need to clear up here right away is the social understanding of sin that we have personalized this passage to mean. I'll just ask you, what would we normally mean is if God punishes to the third and fourth generation?
It would be about a range of probably about 100 years or so, to the great-grandchildren generation.
So if your great-grandfather did something, you could still be getting it, right? You ever thought of that? That's how we normally interpret this, and we forget the social setting of the family in the Old Testament, that when a community of people went against God, the punishment was to the third and fourth generation. Well, who was the head of the clan? great-grandfather. So if the clan itself sinned, it was to the third and fourth, and it meant the whole family that existed together in that place. See, so that's very important that we're not, it doesn't talk about some kind of magical retribution or kind of automatic retribution that will be passed on 50 years later. But it is a retribution. Now, where the theology of retribution is most clearly stated is in what's called the Deuteronomic writings. And you could lift these books out of the Old Testament. And you've probably covered some of this in the Old Testament reading course, so if I get too duplicative here, just give me a whistle. But the Deuteronomic writings, you could pick these out and say originally they were one little booklet. Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. And what they are is one history book, a very neat history book, and it covers a period of history from about the year 1200 to the year about 586. From the time of the entry into the land, the beginning of Deuteronomy is Moses' speeches he gives to the people before they enter the land. And then the history goes all the way through 586 when the southern kingdom falls to the armies of Babylon and they're carried off to the Babylonian captivity. This is called the Deuteronomic history. And the word Deuteronomy just means, I think I'm remembering this now, it means second law. In other words, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, I was going to say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. That's only four. What's the fifth? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy is considered the first law. And then this is the second law. Now, I don't understand where Deuteronomy got into the deal.
Well, it may have just referred to the Ten Commandments, which are repeated there. Mm-hmm. Or it may be that it sums up again what was summed up in Exodus and part of Leviticus.
Maybe I'm wrong then. Maybe the actual D history starts with Joshua. You think?
Okay, but it's based on Deuteronomy.
It's based on Deuteronomy. Yeah. Yeah, it takes the principle of retribution that's in the book of Deuteronomy and then writes a history. Okay, and it's what you call, it's a biased history. And biased here means, in the best sense of the word, biased, in that it wants to prove a point. Now, modern historians would not probably look on this as a good history book, or you take a prejudiced point of view and then you go back over history to prove it's true. If you're a historian, this would not be the most valid. Is that right?
It's called revisionism.
For now, the Deuteronomic writers go back and they want to prove a point over the years and show that it happens. Now I'm going to show you then how this can either come out as what we call dead word or living word. But let's look up some examples. I think this is Deuteronomy. I just wrote the numbers down without writing what book it is. let's try Deuteronomy. 7, 12 to 15. Yeah. This is where you have now the basis of the Deuteronomic understanding of history. Listen to these ordinances, be true to them and observe them. In return, Yahweh your God will be true to the covenant and the kindness he promised your fathers solemnly. He will love you and bless you and increase your numbers. And notice how specific it gets. He will bless the fruit of your body and the produce of your soil, your corn. Now, if you keep the covenant, your corn will be okay. Your wine, your oil, the issue of your cattle, the young of your flock, in the land he swore to your fathers he would give you. You will be more blessed than all peoples. No man or woman among you shall be barren, no male or female of your beasts infertile. God will keep all sickness far from you. He will not afflict you with those evil plagues of Egypt, which you have known, but will save them for all those who hate you. God will put all of the plagues in a bottle and throw them on people that hate you, if you keep the covenant. Now, turn to chapter 8, 19 and 20. Be sure that if you forget Yahweh your God, if you follow other gods, if you serve them and bow down before them, I warn you today, you will most certainly perish. Like the nations Yahweh is to destroy before you, so you yourselves shall perish for not having listened to the voice of Yahweh your God. Okay, now 11, 13 to 17. It is most sure that if you faithfully obey the commandments I enjoin on you today, loving Yahweh your God and serving him with all your heart and all your soul, I will give your land, now look at all of these things, rain in season, autumn rain and spring, autumn rain and spring, so that you may harvest your corn, your wine, your oil. I shall provide grass in the fields for your cattle. You will eat and have all you want. Take care your heart is not seduced, that you do not go astray serving other gods and worshiping them, or the anger of Yahweh will blaze out against you. He will shut up the heavens and there will be no rain. Look at that. If you disobey the covenant, the rain will stop. The land will not yield its produce, and you will quickly die in the prosperous land that Yahweh is giving you. Well, how do you feel about this so far? Linda?
It almost seems like it doesn't have to be interpreted so much as of God coming down and doing this, but that's what it's a statement of reality. So when you... If you live this way, this is the consequence of this. If what you are structuring your society on is not Yahweh or what that means, this is what happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me so much as a picture of God coming and bashing.
Well, I don't see it as a threat. I see it more as he's warning the people, instructing them in the proper ways of doing things, because You know, any farmer will tell you that there's right ways and wrong ways to do things.
And there's a certain retribution that's built right into the cycle. Yeah.
I kind of read stuff like that. I always think it sounds so much more severe than what actually happened. I mean, I keep thinking that if the covenant kept changing, you know, as people continued to turn away, that it was God that changed, the covenant changed, you know, set me the rules way down. I just don't think it happened.
Yeah, let's see.
Well, it's
like you're, excuse me, you're kind of saying, now come now, this didn't really happen quite this neatly, or did
Yeah, I guess you could say that way too.
Well,
it just hit me that right now our God is in our midst, and the effect of that is no life, no rain, no water, no nothing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, it's in that context, it totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't too far-fetched at all.
Yeah.
And it's just a statement of what...
Mm-hmm. We're going to see more and more that biblical people accept retribution from a distance. You know, the problem is when you get too... It's like you can accept it back here when you get up too close and talk about it in relation to individual lives.
No.
Am I sick today because I sinned yesterday? Possibly if you abuse your body. But, you know, Dave?
I was going to say, it reminded me of Hindu karmic philosophy.
Mm-hmm. How's that?
Well, you know, you hear about accumulating good or bad karma. Based on what you do today, you know, it comes back to you.
Yeah, in other words, you almost store it up, right? It's true.
Your actions today are an investment for the future.
Yeah.
Good rain.
That's really close, isn't it? I want to look at now just how this worked in this history book from Deuteronomy through 2 Kings. Now this principle is taken in it, and to show how it worked through history, and that you can almost, through all of these books, you can almost get a cycle like this. The people sin, God punishes, then the people cry to the Lord, and the Lord delivers. Now it's very important when this was written, when the Deuteronomic history was written. Yeah.
I can't read that.
It's a cycle. The people sin, Yahweh punishes, the people cry out to Yahweh, in other words, they repent, metanoia, and then Yahweh delivers them. Then after they're delivered, they sin again, and then God punishes them again, and then they cry out to the Lord again, and then the Lord delivers them again. It's just a cycle all the way through this. Yeah.
I have a problem with the fact that God punishes that part. Because I guess what I was trying to say, I guess I'm not being very clear, just late in the day, But these statements about how all these things that will happen if you do not keep the covenant, like, I never was under the impression that was out of the mouth of God, so to speak. But these were people translating that. It was like, it's not that I don't take it seriously, but it's just like, these are people trying to convey to the rest of the people of Israel that if this is a serious thing that you must try and live the life of the covenant. And I don't see God as coming down with, you know, and depriving her people of all this.
I think they saw it as, well, let's look at, I think a classic passage is Judges 3:7-11. This was how the cycle now was happening during the time of the judges. after the conquest of the land and before the kings, about the year about 1200 to 1000, Judges 3, 7 through 11. Someone shout that out.
And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, forgetting the Lord their God, and serving the Baals and Asherah. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. But when the people of Israel cried to the Lord, and the Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel, who delivered them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. In his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the woman had dressed 40 years. Then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died.
Okay, now this will be it. This will be on our final now, so remember to learn that. Cushan-Rishathaim. Yeah. How do you feel just the pacifism just losing out? And notice here, the people sin by worshiping Baal and the fertility goddess. Then they are punished by going into slavery under this Cushan, that's his first name, 8 years. And then after 8 years of slavery, they cry out to the Lord. Then this is one of the times when the Lord uses their own armies to deliver them. And then they have 40 years of rest until they start really sinning again. And then the cycle will continue. And then they'll be punished again. They'll cry out to the Lord. The Lord will deliver them, and they'll have rest again. And then after their rest, they start worshiping other gods and idols and Baal and the fertility goddess again. And then the cycle repeats itself. Now, this goes until 3, right? That gives us 2 more minutes. I'll put this in the context of Living Word and then pick it up from there on Friday. The Deuteronomic historians were probably teachers in the Babylonian captivity and the exile. This is the theory that I think makes the most sense. And what is critical to them is that if you look at history from the Deuteronomic kind of model here, where were they in the scheme of things when they're in the Babylonian captivity now? Where in the cycle?
They were in the
punishment. Now, what the people in Babylon were tempted to do, and that's why you have this fervor in Babylon of and creative fervor in the what we call Yahweh's faith, was most of them wanted to just give up. Because in the Babylonian captivity, they wanted to accept the idea that was prevalent in the ancient world, and that is, if you were defeated, that means your victor's God was stronger than your God, so you would throw out your weak God and accept the strong God, Marduk, of the Babylonians. And this happened. When I lived in Albuquerque, I did a photography project for Save the Children on the White Mountain Apache Reservation in Arizona. And when I got there, I could tell these people had been over-photographed over the years. When another person came with another camera, they all yawned. But I was very fascinated that in the middle of the reservation, this giant white clapboard Midwestern looking Lutheran church. And then later I found out that at the time of the Second World War that like 80% of this tribe was Lutheran, Wisconsin Synod. You know, how did these people become Lutheran Wisconsin Synod? Well, they were the Apaches were the last tribe to be defeated by the Americans. And they're very proud of the fact that they held out longer than any other Indian tribe, and they're still proud of that when you meet Apache people. But on the day that they signed the peace with the American army and were defeated, the next day an old German Wisconsin Synod missionary came over the hill, and they just all fell down and became Lutheran because they thought he represented now the strong God of the victor. See? So therefore their tribal deities then were weak, you know, so they now turned to the strong God of their victors. Exactly the same theme as what the people in the Babylonian captivity wanted to do. And you can see why the people of faith then had this, it was a life struggle to keep the covenant faith going. And the Northern Kingdom, when they went off to Syria, they bailed out of it. I mean, there just wasn't any more Yahweh religion anymore. They accepted the religion of their conquerors. And you know, so out of this, you have Genesis 1, which is, we call it a creation story. It was really an emotional appeal, if you look in Bible scholarship. Genesis 1 was an emotional appeal to the people to not accept the Babylonian creation stories, but to cling to the God of Israel.
Isn't that where last summer's theme comes from, too?
Oh, the sing the Lord's song in a strange land. Yeah, all of society says when you've lost, you change gods. And now as we sing the Lord's song in the exile. Now, the concern of the Deuteronomic writer was to show that, just say, read the history of Israel. When we're defeated, it does not mean our God is weak, but it means that our God is punishing us. So the writer of the Deuteronomic history now wanted to show that Yahweh is still God of the whole universe, and he's doing, or this God is doing, what God has always done. Therefore, don't leave or don't bail out or don't lose your faith at this time. But we're just in a cycle. And then the assumption is now the Deuteronomic writers then were appealing to the people now, cry out to the Lord, metanoia, repent, turn again to the Lord, and again the Lord will deliver you and there will be rest. So in other words, and this was Ralph Klein's main problem with Simonson, that Simonson tended to make the Deuteronomic theory a theory, propositional truth. Remember we talked about the difference between propositional truth and living word. That he tends to make it this into a proposition, rather a living people that were tempted to lose their faith, and the prophets who now wrote this history book were just pleading with the people to keep the faith. Well, out of this you come with this strong idea that all suffering is a result of God punishing people exactly for their sins. Now, Friday, we've gone a little over now, but Friday I want to start to show how we can argue with this and how the Bible can argue with this. I think it's 3:05. It's time to play. So we'll pick.